It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
This is the Hockey News Podcast.
Welcome to the Hockey News Podcast, presented by BetMGM and McKinney. I'm Mike Stevens. Sitting across from me is Ryan Kennedy. Ryan, how you doing?
Doing great. How's it going?
Not too bad. You know, I can't complain. We're at a higher desk now. This is the tallest I've ever been, and I feel really great. Never a better time to talk about hockey.
Indeed.
Than on a blustery Tuesday morning.
Yes.
In Toronto. Let's dive right into it and talk about a team that I don't think is getting enough real credit right now through the first little bit of the season. It's the New York Islanders. I mean, they're coming on. They're expected to take a bit of a step back. Barry Trotz is gone. No one really knew what the Lane Lambert sort of era was going to be. And yet here they are, right behind the Devils, who are the hottest team in the league. They're 11-6. They've got some really good underlying numbers. Players are sort of chipping in. It's like that old Islanders, you know, the sum of our parts kind of team again. They're fantastic.
They are. And, you know, it's interesting because Lane Lambert was obviously in the organization already, so there was familiarity there, but he does take on a new role as head coach. But, you know, Lane Lambert has been on the cusp of being a head coach for like a decade at this point. You know, we knew there was potential there, so the transition has gone fairly smooth already. I think that they're getting obviously a lot more offense than we're used to. They're actually outscoring the New York Rangers right now. And you think about the firepower that the Rangers have.
Yeah.
But Brock Nelson leading them in scoring. And what's interesting is that last year he had like a wild shooting percentage.
Yes.
Obviously he had a fantastic year from a goal scoring perspective. But he's getting, you know, he's having his best season yet so far. And his shooting percentage is basically his average. You know, he's usually about 15%. For his career, at least in recent years, other than last year. And he's still producing, so that's a great sign. Matt Barzal's playing well, Anders Lee. Noah Dobson, obviously, continuing to ascend as that top pairing. I'll call him a two-way defenseman, but he brings so much offense.
Yes.
He is very well-rounded, and he has that great mobility and size. So, you know, it's coming together, and I think, you know, it's not like they're playing loose hockey, so they're not completely away from the Islanders
not.
We knew. But the goal scoring's coming a little more to the forefront, and they're getting results.
Well, one thing, you talk about the goal scoring, the one person it hasn't come to yet is Matt Barzal.
Because right.
He has, and this is just a credit to him, you know, as a hockey player, 17 games, 18 points, zero of them are goals. He's got 18 assists. So you're going to think that might change a little bit.
Eventually.
You're gonna hope so, at least. I'm not a mathematician here, but I gotta say that, you know, you think the percentage-wise, it's gonna regress back to the mean there.
Yeah.
And, you know, once Barzal, I mean, he's already over a point per game. Once the goals start coming for him, look out, man. It's Matt Barzal.
Exactly.
On a shooting percentage heater.
Yeah.
Come on.
Right now he's like the reverse Cy Young.
Exactly.
Like, I'm trying to think of like who's like the worst baseball pitcher is, but
Yusei Kikuchi, maybe, or
maybe, but
something like that.
You know, it's funny, in MLB The Show, he's like one of
the
aces.
Oh, he's great. Yeah, that's the thing.
Yeah.
It's crazy. I could go on for days with MLB The Show.
Yeah.
But no, it's look, the and one thing as well is Ilya Sorokin. You know, thank you to my fantasy team. Thanks to Ilya. But also, like, he's been fantastic. He's taken the reins, and Varlamov struggled a little bit, but like they have their franchise goalie right now.
They certainly do.
He's older than you'd think, though. He's 27.
Like, it's true, because he spent so much time in Russia, but the upshot of that was he got so much experience, not only in the KHL, but on the international stage as well. And, you know, he's always been a little overshadowed by Igor Shesterkin, because they basically were coming up at the same time. You know, sometimes they even partnered internationally. But, you know, you look at what Sorokin did last year, and, you know, you talk to folks around the league, and, you know, it's like, sort of saying, like, coming into this year, the three best goalies in the league might have all been Russian, with Vasilevsky being the other one. So you know, not a surprise that Sorokin's playing so well, but certainly a boon to the Islanders that he's living up to the hype once again.
Absolutely. They got to get on a that contract, though. I mean, he's only got 1 year left after this one. And then you got to sort of parse through whether or not, you know, you want to give a big contract to a guy who's approaching 30 or might be on the other end of it. But look, man, the Islanders, like this, like we said, this was a team that, you know, we thought was going to take a step back. They signed Matt Barzal to a contract that I personally thought was a bit steep at the time. And even and it's funny to think that he has zero goals through his nearly his first 20 games, and I think he's lived up to his contract.
Like, yeah,
that goes
he's
to show
still one of their top scorers.
Exactly. he's literally like 1 point behind their team lead, and he has zero goals. It's incredible. Like this just goes to show like they really do have something special in that locker room, at least, to keep them together.
And you know what, too, I know there's been criticism in the past of them not doing enough in terms of moves, but there's something to say for having that whole crew together for so long. When you think about Brock Nelson and Anders Lee and Josh Bailey and Matt Barzal has now been there for, you know,
a long
quite
time.
A while as
like
well.
4 or 5 years?
Exactly. And then, you know, I mean, Dobson's one of the newer players, but of course he came up through their system. So there's a lot of familiarity there. And it's like, you know, if it works, it works.
All right. Moving on to a team that, look, this is one of the silver linings in a season that has been nothing but a disaster. For the Vancouver Canucks, at least, you know, we've their coach is on the hot seat every night. The teammates are fighting with each other on the ice. Jerseys are getting thrown. It's just not a good sort of, it's not, the vibes are very much off in Vancouver.
Yeah.
But the one guy who is thriving amidst the chaos, well, he's not the only guy, but there's one person who is thriving amidst the chaos. It's Bo Horvat, the captain.
Yeah.
You know, he's got 13 goals in his first 16 games. He's doing it by getting into, like, the really difficult areas of the ice. He scored on Saturday against the Leafs by, you know, essentially just muscling his way into the slot, tipping it home. So this is not a guy who's just sort of like lofting them in on the outside and getting, you know, getting some good luck.
Yep.
The only problem is that he's a free agent coming up. After the deal with JT Miller, the Canucks, as we said at the start of the season, have $0 in cap space, and they're one of the worst teams in the league. Can they afford Bo Horvat? And at the end of the day, like, what is an extension or a potential next contract even look like for him?
All right, so
you have a hot take. You were talking.
I believe this to be spicy. Okay. Maybe I'm wrong because I'm not really a hot take guy.
And you've kept it a secret, so I'm waiting to hear.
I think the Bo Horvat contract, whether it's with Vancouver or another team, and, you know, obviously cap considerations, I think it's going to be John Tavares-esque.
Wow.
Yes.
Like 11 million?
I'm going to say 10.5. You look at the points he's putting up this year. Let's say that he continues his pace as more than a point per game player.
To be fair, he's shooting 23%. So
yes.
That's going to go down a bit.
Yes. It might.
That's true.
Right. I mean, you know, math not my strong
suit. Well, it might go down like next season, which would be
the worst
time for the team signing him to go down. But
not
still.
For Bo Horvat.
Exactly.
I'm gonna put on my Pat Morris glasses
okay,
here
all
as
right.
the agent. I'm gonna represent Bo Horvat. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna channel Pat Morris and say, look, first PK unit on the Canucks, top power play unit, one of the leading ice time guys. Like, JT Miller's the only forward that has played more time on ice average per game on the Canucks. And it's not a big gulf.
No, it's Bo Horvat's 2052, JT Miller's 2105.
That's exactly. It. So it's pretty much a wash there.
Yeah.
As you said, 13 goals already. You know, he's looking like a monster. In terms of offense, he's the captain.
Yep.
We know that he plays with a ton of passion, and, you know, he's got that grit factor to him. You know, Tavares signed his deal a few years ago now, obviously. So you have to adjust for
the inflation
of the salary cap, which is why they're going to be basically the same age. Mm-hmm. You know, they're both going to be sort of 28 when they sign this deal. So if I'm Pat Morris, I'm saying my boy's worth at least 10, maybe 10.5. And, you know, if you're signing with the Canucks, you want 8 years.
Yes.
If you're on the open market, you can only get 7. That's what I'm asking for, and I believe I can get it. When you look at his production and what he brings to a team all around, you know, Tavares also was a captain when he went to the open market. He was an all-around guy. He might have had a little more of a track record in terms of offense.
Definitely more.
But it wasn't. But again, if Horvat has a monster season this year, then you're saying this is who he is right now.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's my take.
You know what? That's a really good take. Now, the more that you bring that up, like the more arguments and points you get, like the more compelling it is. Because yeah, like Horvat, and one thing too is that, you know, the rumor forever, and I think there is a shred of truth to it, is that the locker room in Vancouver is kind of split between like the Bo Horvat leadership group and the JT Miller sort of leadership group, and it's difficult. I really like, I can't see this guy signing back in Vancouver. Yeah.
And if he did, it would not be for a hometown discount.
Oh, 100% not. Yeah. But the thing is too is that he's been the captain. He's never had sort of what we call an off season. Like, he's kept going. There's never been any sort of like complaints about his own leadership style. Mm-hmm. This isn't a Blake Wheeler situation where we hear sort of it seeping out.
Right.
Any sort of complaints have been, you know, other people and how he's had to sort of massage that situation. Mm-hmm. And look, like the Canucks had put their players, specifically their leadership group, through the ringer. Like, think about all the like, you know, it's your home opener and you have to come out and basically like defend pretty much every organizational figure. And even like, remember during that, during the COVID season, the pandemic season, where the Canucks were just absolutely like massacred with COVID, and mm-hmm. there was a lot of complaints about the organization not like supporting them enough during that and all that, and Horvat was able to sort of massage that down. I mean, he's the guy. Now, I'm looking at John Tavares' numbers right before he signed, mm-hmm. and it, like, he did have, like, Bo Horvat has never had, like, John Tavares, you had an 81-point season in 82 games, you know, in 2011, you know,
yeah.
He was 47 and 48 during the lockout season. He was 66 and 59 the next season before. He was basically close, either above or close to point per game every single year leading up to the deal. And then even in that last season in New York before he signed in Toronto, 37 goals, 47 assists, 84 points in 82 games.
Yeah.
If Bo Horvat can sort of match that, maybe. But you're right. I think it'll be like, I know it's on the open market. He's a center. He's versatile. He's got all these different things. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't go 10.5. Like, I'm sure he'd probably get it, but like maybe 10, 9.75, something. Maybe like a Johnny Gaudreau type kind of deal.
Mm-hmm.
But look, this is a very useful hockey player. I think this is a hockey player who would find even greater success in a situation that's just has a little bit more levity.
Sure.
Because everything just seems heavy in Vancouver right now, right? And he's the captain. He's got to shoulder that load. Every time he steps before cameras, he knows he's got to basically fight for his life when it comes to that, I think. But, look, this is probably the most intriguing free agent that's coming up.
Yeah, I think that's fair because he brings so much to the table. And it's funny, you know, it's like there was a time where when we still thought the NHL was going to go to the last Olympics, where Bo Horvat looked like he could be on that team.
Oh, yeah. He looked like he was at least like a fourth line or something on Team Canada, on one of the most stacked Team Canada rosters.
Yeah.
Any team is going to want him. And, like, I know that it's going to be so difficult for him to, like, make it work cap-wise, but, like, mm-hmm. wouldn't he look so good on, like, the Colorado Avalanche?
Oh, of course.
Yeah, but I mean, like, he just seems like the kind of player, like, that team would just, like, use so effectively.
Yeah.
You know, it'll be great. I mean, I think he's set himself up for quite the payday, and he's earned it, man. He's had to deal with a lot placed on his shoulders. I think he's continued to play, like, as they say, the right way.
Indeed.
Good for him. Speaking of the Olympics, by the way,
mm-hmm.
The best-on-best tournaments have not been something that we've been able to enjoy as hockey observers, as
Indeed.
You say. Now, it came over on the weekend, or I think on Friday, it was announced that the NHLPA the NHL and NHLPA in a joint statement has postponed the 2024 World Cup of Hockey, you know, the best on best, the one that was supported by them in lieu of the Olympics, due to our recent climate, which, I mean, we all know what that means.
Russia.
It's Russia. and so, yeah, we'll keep that, like, everyone kind of knows that.
Yeah.
They're hoping, hey, maybe Russia will chill out a little bit by 2025. Mm. We'll have to see, you never know. Predicting, you know, sort of global politics and whatnot is a fool's errand, if you will, at least in my experience. So this is just another giant shame because Canada's best players are aging even more. Like,
mm-hmm.
Someone pointed out on Twitter, and this is the thing that I like to keep bringing up, is that Nathan MacKinnon, you know, one of the best players in the league, one of the best homegrown Canadian sort of products in the modern era, he will not have played in a best-on-best tournament representing his country.
Uh-huh.
If let's say that the World Cup of Hockey goes in 2025, let's say that's the best case scenario, it all works out.
Yeah.
He will not have played in a best-on-best tournament until year 12 in the NHL. That's wild. Unacceptable.
Yeah.
Connor McDavid has never played in the Olympics.
Yeah.
The one time he's worn a Team Canada jersey after the World Juniors is the World Championship.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah, and then you think about on the American side, you know, guys like Austin Matthews
and Jack Eichel.
You know, I know they want to play at least one best on best with Patrick Kane.
Yeah.
And, you know, that generation from before them. So, I mean, it's tough. And it is one of those things where, you know, everything is so interconnected in hockey. And, you know, at the IIHF level, it's pretty easy for them to say, well, look, like, you know, we can't have Russia competing right now.
Of course.
Because it's national federations. But then when you get to NHL/NHLPA, it's like, the Russians are on the same club teams as the Canadians, the Americans, the Swedes, the Finns. Like, they're all interconnected, and there's not much to say at this point other than it's really too bad. And for me, I would say, hold it without Russia.
But then it's not best on best.
And you're right, it's not best on best.
Yeah.
But with the previous World Cup where you had Team North America and Team Europe. You know, I know initially the Swiss, the Slovaks, they weren't happy that they couldn't represent their own country. Mm-hmm. Now, they made that great run to the final,
and they
came together as a team, so that was very nice for them. But, you know, we've seen it before, at least. Maybe not with a hockey superpower like Russia, but concessions have been made before.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, everybody involved decided we'd prefer to wait, and hopefully we can do it the right way. But you're right. It's really too bad because we're all fiending to see McDavid, Matthews, McKinnon, as you mentioned, all these young players. Shesterkin and Sorokin for that matter. And Vasilevsky, right? Those are all matchups we want to see. And thanks, Putin. we don't get it. So you just hope that we get peace in Ukraine, and then from there, we can start making hockey decisions.
What's really disappointing to me is that the era that's before the Matthews and McDavid and all that, like, they got their moments. The 2010 Olympics in Vancouver is an iconic event. Like, everyone still references it now.
Yeah.
Like, we still have, you know, every time the golden goal gets scored, the anniversary, we talk about it. There's infographics all over Instagram and stuff like that. But the Ovechkins, Sidney Crosby, all the American players, like Patrick Kane, all that, like, they got their sort of defining cool moments that will go down in hockey history. And I think that, like, legacy is extremely important to this new generation of hockey fans, or not hockey fans, but hockey players.
Yeah.
Like, Matthews cares about his legacy so much. We were there, in Tampa when he was doing his media availability for the Hart, and he kind of looked nonplussed about it. He's like, yeah, it's cool. It's great to have an MVP. I want my legacy to be a champion, you know?
Right.
And I think everyone kind of focuses on that, and they haven't had that opportunity to do it. And, like, the clock is ticking. Like, you know, if it gets pushed back past 2025, like, these guys will be approaching their 30s. Like, at that point, you know, will they still be in their primes? Will Patrick Kane still be playing so they're able to play with him? Like, can you imagine? Like, we got the Canada versus USA gold medal game, incredible stuff. Imagine what it would be like to have a McDavid-led Canada and a Matthews-led USA going at each other, some great goalies on tap there. Like, you know, it's like, after now that it's going to get pushed back, like, there's almost zero chance that Marc-Andre Fleury is going to be on the team now.
True.
And so he's never gotten a chance to start at an Olympics or a best on best at this point. Like, it's just like, you wanted to get that one last shot for the last generation, and also have this new generation in their primes, the height of their powers, be able to be those headline players. And now that looks like it might be over.
Yeah.
And it's just such a shame. Like, they were already rushing to get this done by 2024. You can't predict global events, but I just, people, this was kind of swept under the rug, this story. Like, it didn't get a ton of traction, but this sucks.
Yeah.
Like, it really does.
Yeah.
I really wanted to see this. It's a shame. But things that are not a shame. The New Jersey Devils, they're still the hottest team in the league. I believe they're still winning. I think they're still on a 9-in-a-row win streak
here.
They're
on a heater.
Incredible. Their fans put together what was one of the funniest, I think, moments of the season, and one of the funniest sort of fan reactions in recent memory, because They and I at the time it wasn't necessarily oddly that they did it, but they booed Lindy Ruff and chanted "Fire Lindy" in their home opener.
Yeah,
you know, and Lindy Ruff looked surprised by it on the bench. He was like, "What? Really? Me? Like, all right." And then after the 9 games in a row, after they look like the hottest team in the league, after everything is just gelling so well in New Jersey, they look like they're set up for the present and the future. The fans get together, go, "Sorry, Lindy."
Yes.
Incredible. And Lindy Ruff, after the game, in his post-game preference, said, "You know what? I accept the apology. And maybe one time, us and the 17,000 other people can all, excuse me, can all get together and have a beer together."
Yeah.
Which I think is lovely. It also brought to mind as well, like, who's another coach who deserves a "Sorry, blank" chant? You know, someone who's been maligned pretty heavily this year, and now has proven, like, okay, I deserve an apology.
All right, I'm gonna give a personal apology. Dave Haxtell in Seattle.
Yep.
I think the Kraken are a wagon.
Can I piggyback on this
apology? You can certainly piggyback on that because, yeah, I mean, early on, it looked like the Kraken, you know, they weren't having success on the ice. And, you know, I still don't like that Shane Wright's not a regular on the team.
I don't either, yep.
But when you're winning, it's hard to, you know, it's hard to find fault there. But, I mean, they have a better record than the Oilers and the Flames.
They sure do.
How many people saw that coming
Zero.
In the offseason? And, you know, I mean, they're more talented than they were last year. But, again, you know, I mean, they don't have a traditionally strong lineup, but they're making it work. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of funny because Dave Haxtell in his coaching career, if you go back to when he was at the University of North Dakota, traditionally his squads would start a little slow and then they would catch fire in the second half.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. And we saw that a little bit in the NHL with Philadelphia as well. Clearly, he has sorted out that where the first couple of weeks were dicey, but now, I mean, we're not that far into the season and Seattle's already really sort of got a foothold there in the division. I mean, again, it's early, but they're in a playoff spot.
Yeah.
You know, and it's coming together. They're getting contributions from all over the place. Martin Jones is back.
He's doing his thing.
Don't know if he was ever technically there, but now he's back.
He's back, yep.
So the fact that they're getting those sort of next guy steps up contributions, because they do have some injuries too, I think bodes really well for them. And so, yeah, I would say, sorry, Dave Haxtell, you're doing a bang-up job there. I don't know how, but it's working.
See, I thought that Dave Haxtell was going to be like the weak link of the team because I looked at their lineup, I looked at the moves they made in the offseason. I really enjoyed them, like the Oliver Bjorkstrand trade.
That was huge.
Was fantastic.
Yeah.
Getting Justin Schultz in there as like a veteran sort of like pillar of the blue line or support piece, you know, like, you know, another step forward for Beniers. You still have good players in like Eberle, Schwartz, like they signed Burakovsky, but also like Yanni Gourde is still there.
Totally.
Jared McCann is still there. He's the first player to sign a contract extension for them. You know, like Brandon Tanev is going to be healthy and he's very beloved and he adds sort of like a good sort of energy level to the bottom six.
For sure.
You know, and then you're thinking, all right, so maybe you can get Philip Grubauer back and he's going to be that $5.9 million goalie you signed him for this and that and the other. Yeah, he's been injured most of the time. Now you have like you said, a Martin Jones, and now Magnus Helberg is back.
That's right.
You know, he was there, and now he's back.
The waiver king.
He's this year's Philip Forsberg. You know, like a couple years ago, Philip Forsberg was waived like 4 different times.
Not Philip Forsberg.
Anton Forsberg.
There we go. That makes a lot of sense.
I thought that Dave Haxtell was going to be like the thing that holds them back.
Mm-hmm.
No, he's really putting that team together.
And
the biggest thing I can say with Seattle is that last year, like, if you're going to be an expansion team, like at least be exciting.
Sure.
If you're not going to be good, at least sort of be exciting. Bring some cool stuff in here, some different players, make some trades. They were just sort of very, like, I was just so apathetic towards the Kraken last year.
Right.
Just a very dull team. Not much happened. They weren't really good at one particular thing. Then they traded all their good players at the deadline, and it was just them and, like, a bunch of second-round picks and all that, and it was it. This year, like, they have really good depth at all positions, basically. They have an all-world prospect just waiting in the wings, ready to rock. And they have, and another one is you know, in their top six, like, just killing it. This is a very fun team. And good for Dave Haxtell, man.
For sure. And, yeah, I think Matty Beniers is a big part of it because, you know, last year they just didn't have centers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, I still think that you're going to need to see the ascension of Shane Wright in the next coming years to really fortify that. But right now, you know, Matty Beniers is doing that job. And it's funny because I've said this before, but I think GM Ron Francis This past summer, he had the summer we thought he would have the year before.
Yeah.
Where he stocked up for the draft. I thought they drafted really well. You know, not only obviously Shane Wright fell to them at four, but you know, Jagger Furkus was a great pickup.
Yeah.
You know, they got a goalie for the future in Nicholas Koko. You know, Yanni Niemann was another intriguing player that they drafted. So, and they had a bunch of picks, which you always like. You know, Ty Nelson, another player, very intriguing. And then they made, and then they took advantage of teams that were in cap crunches to get Oliver Bjorkstrand, for example. So it was like delayed a year, but now it's happened. And I thought it would take a little longer, but so far,
I'm gonna offer a very hesitant apology to, like a half apology, because I don't fully believe in him yet, still. But he's got numbers to back it up. It's Peter DeBoer.
Oh yeah,
I do not believe in Peter DeBoer as a coach at all.
Really?
I really I thought that he took over a very good Vegas team and they did nothing but not be good under him, and they did nothing but sort of like cause controversy. The sword through Marc-Andre Fleury, you know, Robin Leonard getting blasted while playing through, you know, like heinous injuries.
Yeah.
It just seemed like the dressing room, like I didn't believe it. They went over to the Stars and I'm like, the Stars have even less talent than the Golden Knights that he just got fired from, and they're already applauding, like a very plodding defensive team. Top heavy, and yet here the Stars are. Their top line is absolutely killing it. Ben and Sagan look a bit rejuvenated.
Yep.
Ottinger's playing great. Obviously, we talked about Jason Robertson, but you know Miro Heiskanen's killing it. I just think that he's done a good job at keeping that collection of talent productive. And you know, I'm gonna offer. I don't think that it's like I haven't fully believed that it's him yet.
Right.
But in terms of, if I had to choose one, like in terms of any sort of coach that I want to offer an apology to, because there are a lot that I want to like rescind apologies to.
Yeah.
That I think have gone maybe into new places or something. Want to you know make it then made their situations worse.
Right.
But DeBoer, he's kept it going.
Yeah.
In Dallas and done better than I thought he would. So, if I can offer a half apology to you, Peter, I hope you accept it.
There you go. And you know what I will say, if you talk to folks in the coaching community. Mm-hmm. Peter DeBoer is one of the most well-respected coaches.
Really? I did not know that.
Huge. Like, when he speaks, a lot of other coaches listen.
I wonder why.
He's just got that sort of gravitas about them, I guess, the way he thinks the game. And it's kind of funny just picking up on that in terms of, like, it's not a trade per se, but Rick Bowness going from Dallas to Winnipeg and then Peter DeBoer going into Dallas, that worked out for everybody because Winnipeg's red hot. And Bonus seems to have figured out what they needed to take things to the next level. Because the Jets have really been kind of
they've been in stasis, basically.
Yes, the perfect term for it. Yeah, and then with Dallas, it's like, okay, well, we know you can lock it down, and we know you can grind it out in the playoffs, but can you unlock some of these guys? And just as you said, you know, Jamie Benn, I think he had a hat trick last week.
Yeah.
And Tyler Seguin seemed to be a bit rejuvenated there. Maybe it was just they needed a change in structure. Whereas the Jets needed more structure, and that's where Rick Bowness succeeds. So I think Peter DeBoer has sort of loosened the reins in Dallas, and that has been a tonic for the Stars. Rick Bowness did the opposite in Winnipeg because that's what the Jets needed, so it's worked out for everybody.
What I love about what Rick Bowness has done, what I love is that he has cut through all of the crap in Winnipeg. There was so much like politics, posturing, just like, to put in a Leaf-centric like view, like there was just so much like blue and white disease there. It just seemed like like Blake Wheeler and Mark Scheifele were like the untouchable kings of that locker room, and what they would say goes even if it wasn't in the best interest of the team, and you couldn't question either of them if they didn't play defense. You know, you had to just let it go. He went in there and he's like, "You're not the captain anymore." He went there. He took one look at the leadership group. He went, "This isn't working. Clearly, you're not the captain anymore. We're going to do a rotating thing of assistants. You have to play defense. I'm not going to be scared to bench you.
Yeah.
Not going to be scared to call you out. And he had the respect where he's able to come in there and them not be like, who is this guy? Like they were able to do it, and it's working out. Like, look, Winnipeg is, they're not, like they are sort of red hot, and you say, but they only have like 19 points on the year. Like I think it'll be tight for them to make the playoffs even.
Sure.
But based on where they were trending,
and
I've a Jets fan who's a very good friend of mine who was on like suicide watch most of last year, basically. Like he was really upset with what they were in.
Yeah.
Like there's something trending in the right direction, and they still have to figure out the Ville Heinola thing. That's something that it seems like, you know, all these old school coaches just don't like him for some reason.
Yeah.
But look, there's like there's just a calm in Winnipeg now.
Yes.
There's no
much better than it was.
100%. And good for Rick. Like, I will offer an apology there. And even still, like, and then his assistants have been able to keep up the slack when he's had to miss a couple games due to, I believe, dizziness spells or vertigo spells. So good for him. Like, good for that. It seems like there's a really good staff there too. Mm-hmm. And a hallmark of a good coach is hiring a good staff to support him.
Very true.
You know, a leader, the best thing you got to do as a leader is delegate. You know that. There you go. Good for him. All right. The last topic, I guess, before we play, before rapid fire and we play my favorite game in the world, Ryan gave me a little sneak peek of it.
That's right.
Is Zach Borensky out for the year, torn labrum. First of all, I think people have now underrated Zach Borensky because people only thought he was a very one-dimensional defenseman. If you look at his underlying numbers, he's an incredible two-way defenseman, a very, very good player, a player that you take away from that blue line and it is going to be ravaged, as it already is. Boqvist is out as well.
Yes.
Columbus is just like on a one-way ticket to the deep. Like, after what was supposed to be their season where they take a step forward, they sign Johnny Gaudreau, they give Patrick Laine a huge extension. You know, you're hoping for the bounce back from Elvis Merzlikins. You know, they Adam Boqvist is hoping to take a step forward. All of their younger guys, you know, they have Kent Johnson, all these guys who are going to come in the lineup. And yet, nothing has really worked. Jack Roslovic is going to be a healthy scratch tonight, that they say, even with all the injuries that they have. It is not looking great. So now, it looks like they might be a front runner for Connor Bedard.
Yes.
Which brings into question, like, and I'm, you know, this is one, not going to be the first time we have this conversation, seems, but like, what's the best destination for Connor Bedard?
I honestly think it is Columbus at this point. Arizona would be the other obvious one.
Anyone but Arizona.
Fair.
Don't leave him there.
I'm looking at, he can wear shorts to the rink, he can golf. Yeah, it's lovely.
We'll never hear from him again.
It'll be fine. Because then you go, could Connor Bedard, Logan Cooley in the future? That's a great 1-2 punch down the middle.
Okay.
But Columbus, it works very well for them because if you look at the Blue Jackets right now, if they were all healthy, and I totally agree, it's so funny, like Werenski, you're right, like he was taking a bunch of flack last year, and it's like, is this the same Zach Werenski I remember from the NTDP and from the University of Michigan that was so integral and such a good two-way guy? Like, I couldn't see the hate.
Yeah.
Anyways, Patrick Laine also injured.
Yes.
Nick Blankenberg's been injured, you know, and that was like a freebie for them because they signed him as a free agent out of Michigan, and he's been nothing but great for them since.
Things are not going great in Columbus.
No,
right
they're
now.
Just getting killed by injuries, and it's really too bad. But if you look at the makeup of the Blue Jackets, you know, Gaudreau and Laine, I mean, those are your guys on the wings for offense, no question. Zach Werenski is your number one defenseman. I do agree, you know, Boqvist, once he's healthy and gets more reps, he's going to be fantastic for them. I was never really sure about the goaltending, but you can find goaltenders in the future if you need to. And maybe Daniel Tarasov ultimately is the answer for
them. Yeah, who knows?
Right? But you look down the middle, and, you know, they came into the season with Boone Jenner, with Gaudreau and Laine, kind of by default, because, you know, your other option was Cole Sillinger, who's still a teenager, amazingly enough. So if I'm looking at a best-case scenario in Columbus, sort of, let's say, 2 years from now, it's Connor Bedard's your number one center, and then either Cole Sillinger or Boone Jenner is your number two, and the other guy's your number three, or somebody else, because Boone Jenner can play on the wing as well. I suppose you could put Cole Sillinger on the wing if you wanted as well. But, I mean, Connor Bedard is your number one, you know, goal-scoring, creative production. You put him with Laine and Gaudreau, and it's just going to be bonkers. But Sillinger and Jenner would be great in that middle six role because both of them have size, they have a bit of snarl, but they also have talent, and they have a bit of versatility. So I think that would be a great combination. The other team, we talked about this before we went on, would be Ottawa.
Yeah.
Where, Josh Norris, and, you know, he's hurt right now, but they do have centers, but they also have guys that can play wings. So you look at Tim Stützle, who's playing center right now, I still think he's probably better on the wing in a perfect scenario. And you do have Claude Giroux, who, again, you know, has played center quite a bit in his career, but has also played wing and has had success at both. So you look at, if you add Connor Bedard in there, then all this, and then you also have Shane Pinto, who's been amazing. We talked about him last week. So then you get a scenario where, okay, Connor Bedard's obviously your number one. You know, Josh Norris is probably your two, and Stützle goes to the wing. You know, maybe Giroux is on the wing on either the first or second line. Mm-hmm. And then Shane Pinto becomes kind of an elite third line center, or again, you put him on the wing. But if you have him as your elite third line center, because that's a guy that he's athletic, you know, he's a strong kid, but he can also score for you. So that's like kind of a great matchup if you're Ottawa, if you're putting him against different combinations, if he's going against other bottom six lines, or if you're matching him against a top line, I think he could have value as well. So you just get so many great options there. Mm-hmm. But yeah, again, if you look at perfect fits, Columbus, certainly, because you also have Kent Johnson coming up as a winger, where you can have talent spread out over those top two lines and really become a matchup problem for other teams.
Yeah, I fully agree. Like I was talking, you know, Rachel and I were talking about this on Staff and Graph, where we thought Columbus would be a perfect example. They're middle of middle America. A team that needs sort of like they've just gotten a lot of starts, but they need, I think, one more big name to really put them over the top. Mm. And they're a team that just like it can work there. I think it is working, but it can be taken to another level, yeah. I think. And getting a generational star like Bedard, that would be great. I also think that like in a perfect world, I think Gary Bettman wants Connor Bedard in the American market. You know, he would want them because, well, Columbus is not, like, it's not a small market, mm-hmm. like, but it's not a big market, obviously. And I think
Bedard, it's an Ohio State town.
Exactly. And I think Bedard would take that from sort of like that mid-market into a bigger sort of, like it's a ridiculous comparison here, but, like, he could maybe do what, like, a LeBron James kind of did
But I was thinking the same
Cavaliers.
Thing. Yeah,
like,
exactly.
It may be not obviously on the same level because LeBron is, like, arguably the best basketball player of all time.
Yeah.
But, like, Bedard can take that market and elevate it, kind of like what Crosby did with Pittsburgh. Like, totally. It already was a great market, and it was really in a bad place before he got there, and then he took it and elevated it into, like, one of the best markets in the league now.
In both Pittsburgh and Columbus, you have fan bases that will turn out and want to support the team, but eventually need to see results. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so now we're going to look at a Columbus team that could potentially sell a lot towards the end of the year. We're going to see likely David Yurecek play a lot more games, really see what he's got in store.
Indeed.
It will be fascinating to watch them, maybe not from a perspective of like, oh, they're going to be the potential playoff contender that we were thinking of them to be, but based on the assets they have, the draft capital that they could bring in, and also the fact that like they have potentially a franchise defenseman waiting in the wings who will now be given just sort of free reign to go and potentially play in the top four role for the rest of the season.
Yeah.
Let's see what happens.
We're going to see what Emil Bemstrom's got.
Oh, yeah. Let's do it. All right. Topics are over. We don't have any mailbag questions this week because we wanted to give enough time to Ryan's favorite game in rapid fire for me.
Yes.
Take it away, Ryan.
All right. Do you want to start off with that, or should we save it for last?
Oh, we'll save it for last.
Okay,
let's do it.
We'll keep the drama going. Okay, so number one podcast question. Mm-hmm. Since I saw it last week, and I know you probably saw it in theaters multiple times, how'd you feel about Don't Worry, Darling?
I actually haven't seen it.
Really?
No, I know.
Incredible. Your girl.
I know the Florence Pugh is my wife.
Yeah.
But I haven't been able to see it yet.
Wow.
Mainly because I know that she's great in it, but I've heard a lot of like sort of middling things on there, mm-hmm. and I don't know. I've had a really difficult time sort of like thinking that the movie will be more interesting than the drama that surrounded it.
Fair.
And I feel like I just got like my fill for that, but I am going to watch it.
All right.
And now that it is on streaming,
yes.
Because I was like, you know what? I don't want to pay to like go to a theater. I don't want to take that like
that
time.
Risk.
Yeah, just because like I don't want to go and see like a 37% movie on Rotten Tomatoes, mm-hmm. Like in theaters like that. No matter how much I love Florence Pugh, but I've heard nothing but great things about her in that movie.
Yeah, I won't spoil it. Obviously, I'll give it a 7.5 out of 10.
Really? Okay.
It's like it's good enough.
Yeah.
I knew all the back stuff. My wife did not know all the controversy.
Oh, really?
And so when she watched it, she was like, "That was pretty good," and she's walked it back a little bit. But I would say it's still good enough.
I feel like, again, I haven't seen the movie, but based on the cast, based on the talent involved, like Olivia Wilde. Because have you seen Booksmart that she did?
Oh yeah,
Booksmart's fantastic. It's great. And like it should have been so much better than it was. Like this should be an Oscar contender. Mm. You have like this generation's Meryl Streep as your lead. You know, even though Harry Styles apparently is a bit of a weak link in the movie.
No, actually, he's
is he fine?
Decent.
Okay, yeah,
he's
but
fine.
Like Chris Pine is good in everything.
Yeah,
you know, even you got like Nick Kroll in like supporting role, like yeah. You know stuff like that. It should have been so much better than people are saying it is. Uh-huh. Like you shouldn't have to talk in a high voice when you describe it to me. You have to go
right.
Like, oh, it's fine. You know,
that's
like
all right.
It should be like, oh, that was good.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah. No, I think it's fair.
I will see it and I will report back next podcast.
There you go.
Yeah.
Sidebar question: do you think she'd be as famous if she pronounced her name Florence Pug?
I don't know. Mm. Or maybe, you know, maybe due to the memes, maybe she would be even more popular.
Possibly.
Yeah.
And if she had a dog, would she name it Florence Pug?
Would that be a little too self-serving?
I don't know.
Naming your own dog after yourself?
It might be a little like, I don't know, it'd be kind of funny.
It would be funny, but also like what, like, oh, hey, Florence, what's your, like, you got a cool dog. What's your dog's name? Oh, Florence Pug.
Florence Pug.
Oh, so you named your dog after yourself.
Yeah.
That seems a little weird.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Fair enough. Okay.
My wife is too humble to do that.
That's fair. That's fair. Okay. Hall of Fame weekend. We just got through that, and it was lovely. Who has still been snubbed by the Hall of Fame?
Alexander McGillney. Without it, like, there's no question.
Yeah.
He should be in there right now, and he should have been in there this year. And he should definitely be in there next year.
Mm-hmm.
Like, McGillney should have been a borderline first ballot guy. And if you look at the people who are up for next year, I mean, like, obviously Lundqvist is going to get in.
Yeah.
I think Seabrook has a good chance of getting in, like, maybe not on first ballot, but second, like, because he's eligible now, just based on the fact that he was one of the best, or if not the best, defensive defenseman of his era and won all those cups.
Yeah.
Justin Williams is up in the next slot, but I think even he might have to take a... Mike is not a first ballot guy.
Yeah.
Because he was never, like, he never won a major award for himself.
Yeah. He might be Hall of Very Good.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But Alex McGillney, like, this is a trailblazer. Like, he was.
Totally.
Like, he had to escape, like, Russia.
In, literally,
like,
defected.
The dead of night. Like, he risked his life, his family's life, his career, everything to come to North America. And then he comes in and he does nothing but rack up just absolutely torrid production.
Yeah.
He should be in the Hall, no question. The fact that it's taken this long,
they
had these weird vendettas. Like, it was like Pat Burns, where like they decided not to put Pat Burns in the Hall until after he passed.
Yeah.
And for so many, like, the guy won three Jack Adams. Like, he's a remarkable coach. For some reason, the Hall has these, I'm not sure if they're vendettas, I'm not sure if they're blind spots, but for some reason they just snub these very obvious choices. It's one every couple years.
Yeah.
And I don't get it. Alex McGillney should be in there right now. And if he's not next year, it's a travesty. The fact that Gary Bettman's in the Hall and not Alexander McGillney, I think is annoying to me. Because I think that...
Well, because Bettman's still working.
Exactly. Yeah. And the fact that McGillney, like, all that he did, it's not even just that he was an incredible hockey player when he was here.
Mm.
It's that, like, it's that him defecting, like, him leaving in the dead of night, like, stowing away on a ship, basically, just to get over here. It paved the way. Like, we were talking a lot about Boris Salming this weekend because he was getting honored, and how his, like, him coming into the league at a time when, you know, it was all North American players, he paved the way for Swedish players to play in the league.
Yeah.
That's why Sheldon Keefe started an all-Swedish starting lineup, because he said pretty much all these guys wouldn't be here if it were not for Boris. And McGillney did a lot of the same things with Russian players.
Totally agree.
And the fact that he's not in the Hall is absurd.
The correct answer is Alex McGillney.
There you go.
So there you go. Okay, next question. Who does pop culture deserve an apology from? And what I mean by that is an artist, whether it's music, movie, whoever, who are we too hard on when they were around?
Oh, like who should we apologize to?
Exactly.
Okay, I thought you were saying like who owes us an apology?
Oh, no, that list is too long.
Oh man, that's a really good question. I mean, the obvious answer was Britney Spears for a while, like because, you know, but I think we've all given that apology to her now. Like,
right.
Man, holy smokes. This is a really good question. I feel like there's a really good answer to this, and I'm trying to think. It'll definitely be a pop star of some sort, because we just treat them terribly.
Right.
I mean, like, I would say Janet Jackson, maybe, just like,
oh, that's
due,
a good
like
one.
Due to what happened
sure.
at the fact that, like, Justin Timberlake was the one that caused that wardrobe malfunction, yet she was, like, blasted for it.
Good one.
I would say, man, like that, I think that would be a good one. Maybe Miley Cyrus.
Okay.
Or no, I mean, Selena Gomez. I gotta go with that. I mean, her documentary, she has this documentary that came out. I haven't seen it yet, but like basically it delves into just the horrendous treatment that the media did to her. Like the fact that, you know, she was dating Justin Bieber and then it broke up, and yet still people are like asking her about it. Like this is something like it's, and just even like she's gone through a ton of medical, like she had to get a kidney transplant. She has, I believe she has Lyme disease. And she has, I think lupus, I think as well. And so all of that has caused her to sort of like, you know, her body to go through, you know, different transformations and stuff. And the media would come down on her like crazy. And, you know, when she was 15 and like going to the beach with her friends, like adult male photographers would be following after her with cameras and stuff. And just, you know, like when you're in that awkward stage, like anyone looks at you the wrong way and you want to like crawl into a hole. And the fact that she had like, you know, magazine covers and talk show hosts just like dissecting her body and her looks and that, I just think it was terrible. And it was just, so I think that she deserves, I think she's getting an apology now, but I think she deserves a big apology from us because like everyone was just so needlessly hard. And she's just like, she just seems like a cool person. She just likes, she likes to cook. She has her own cooking show. Like she just chills. She's a good actress, a good singer. Like people were just way too hard on her.
Fair. Yeah. All right. Mine's less serious.
Okay.
Stone Temple Pilots.
Okay.
As a, I was a 14-year-old/15-year-old when they came out, and you know, on behalf of all the 14-year-olds in North America, I would like to apologize. We were way too hard on them just because they were from San Diego and not Seattle.
Okay.
And everybody called them posers. It's like, you guys can't be grunge. You're not from Seattle. But like, they really stood the test of time. Like, Interstate Love Song, when that comes on the radio, I'm like, yeah, that's a great track. And like the one from the Crow soundtrack, I can't remember the name of it now. It's like Big Heavy or something like that. It's like a lot of their songs really stood up.
Yeah.
And yeah, we were merciless. Not that they ever cared. I mean, I'm sure they got the question a lot of times when they were on like MTV and Much Music or whatever. But yeah, whatever, man. They're from San Diego. They can't help that. But in the end, I think they did quite well. So there you go. Sorry, Stone Temple Pilots.
In terms of
you were better than we let on.
Quickly, in terms of a band, Nickelback, obviously.
No.
Like no, I.
They deserve no.
They okay, but they sympathy. Didn't. They didn't deserve to be like the like synonymous with bad music.
Sure, they did.
They're like some of their songs are. I don't think that they make great music. Let's not be.
Yeah.
But like, if you're at a sporting event and they put on like "Burn It to the Ground," or they put on like even their cover of "Saturday Night." By Elton John, like that gets me going, you know. And I think that's important. All their songs sound the same, but I think that they fit a certain venue of life. What be that like UFC fights or you know like mosh pits or something like that, which I think is fine. And I don't think that they deserve to be synonymous with like bad music. You know, I think that there are far worse bands out there.
My problem is that they're derivative. Like they go back in that like the way that it's sort of all shook out going back to grunge is you had the bands like Nirvana and Soundgarden and Pearl Jam, and then you had the echoes of those bands.
Yes.
And then eventually you got to Silverchair, and then after that you had like Seven Mary Three and even worse bands, and then you had Nickelback.
Okay, okay.
All doing the same playbook, so that's my gripe.
Okay, that makes sense. That makes sense.
Let's both come together for the classic rapid fire game. Was he a Ranger?
Yes.
A game we used to play years ago under the sort of, you know, topic of, you know, especially back in the 1990s when the New York Rangers, you know, they won a Stanley Cup. They were also very competitive other years. Glenn Sather was their GM. He had been GM, of course, of the Firewagon Edmonton Oilers when they were winning Cups. So there was a lot of trades being made at the time. It has sort of continued on. So when we think back to that era, there are a lot of players where we say, was he a Ranger? Even if it was for only a season or two. So we're bringing it back. I know you're a youngin', so there's a bit of a
I'm ready to rock, man.
Trial
I'm
there.
I'm excited.
All right, so we are going to start off with a classic 80s, 90s goaltender. Bill Ranford played for the Oilers, played for the Bruins, but was he a Ranger?
I'm going to, you know what, he seems like the kind of guy who they would sign for like 1 year at the end of his career. I'm going to say yes.
Bill Ranford, not a Ranger.
Oh, no.
No. Okay. All right. Okay. Next one.
All right. Let's go.
Okay. Marty McSorley, often associated with Wayne Gretzky, played for the Kings, played for the Oilers. Was he a Ranger?
Yes.
Marty McSorley was a Ranger for 9 games.
Wow.
That's it?
It's
pretty amazing.
Because I had hockey cards all back in the day from this era, and you know, just I don't have a photographic memory, but I do have sort of associations, and I'm just racking my brain like, can I picture Marty McSorley in a Rangers uniform in that old helmet? Can it be blue? I did, yeah.
So, and that is the crux of this game.
Exactly.
Can you picture it?
Can you picture it?
It's more spiritually.
Exactly.
It's like, yeah.
There's some that like, there's some really deep cuts that I do know, but mainly it's like, can I picture this person in like red and blue or blue and red? Like it, yeah, okay.
Yes, okay. He is now the GM of the Anaheim Ducks. He's known for the Hartford Whalers and New Jersey Devils, but Pat Verbeek, was he a Ranger?
Yes.
Yes, he was.
Yes, he was a Ranger. Yeah.
Two seasons, season and a half.
I can't remember. I think I had a Ranger hockey card of Pat Verbeek, you know. So
there you go.
Interesting.
All right. Speaking of Hall of Famers, Larry Murphy, the defenseman. Obviously, he played in Toronto. Obviously, he played in Detroit. Obviously, he played in Pittsburgh. Was he a Ranger? Obviously, he was a Capital, too.
Oh,
Larry Murphy got around. He had a long career.
See, I feel like... I might have to go against my gut on this one. I don't think he was a Ranger.
Larry Murphy, not a Ranger. Well played. Well
yes.
Done.
Okay.
And the final one, a callback to last year's
round. Here we go.
Last week's rapid fire. Ole Jokinen, was he a Ranger?
Oh, he was a Ranger. Yeah.
You say that with such conviction.
Because I know he was.
For 26 games, Ole Jokinen was a Ranger.
He was a big deadline pickup for them.
There you go.
I remember that. Yeah. I believe he came over from, I believe that was... Because he was with Florida forever.
Yep.
And I believe that was like the Rangers were the team that picked him up at the deadline. Like they were the Islanders to his Ryan Smith, you know?
Right,
like,
right.
And I believe it was like, remember when Eric Staal was a Ranger for a little bit, like for that half season? It was like that. Like the Rangers are big on getting these guys and being with these teams forever. Mari St. Louis, another one at the deadline.
Wow,
like they keep doing this, right? And Ole Jokinen was another one of those players where they're like, he's a legend in this one franchise. He's still a good player, but he's getting older. All right, let's pick him up the deadline for a run.
There you go. Well done. You comported yourself quite well.
I think, what, 80%?
Yeah.
Like, something like that? Yeah,
good job.
Not bad. Not bad.
Excellent. Well
better done. Than anything I got in school, I'll tell you that. So there we go. Well, that brings us to the end of the show. Another great episode, I think, that we had with each other. Very interesting to see kind of what goes on forward. And obviously, you know, choose BetMGM for your betting needs. TheHockeyNews.com for your lovely hockey content that are produced by me, Ryan, and our lovely staff. We'll see you next week.